Well, welcome back, everybody. This is actually the 1st of April today. It's Easter Monday, and it's freezing cold in London. It's one of the coldest winters since I was born back in 1947, which was one of the legendary cold winters. Snow till April, apparently. Nevertheless, I'm preparing the program for the 1st of May, which will be my 50th program. So I wanted to do something special, and I was wondering what to do. And I think the best thing, really, is simply to give you another track of all my ultra-favorite performers on 78 RPM. And when you do that, you have to begin with the greatest tenor on record, Enrico Caruso. Now, the trouble with Caruso is just about every record he made, with only a couple of exceptions, were definitive performances. So which one to choose? Well, it so happens that recently I bought a bundle of 78s from an auction site, among which were a couple of records which were pressed in vinyl from original pre-World War I matrices. They did this in the 1950s, sometimes when they were reissuing records. The one I have has a plain white label, with somebody scribbling on it the best one we have available or something like that. But I bid for it sort of blind because they said they didn't know who was on it. Luckily, I have books, so I looked up the number and I knew it was a Caruso. So here you have a sort of pristine 78, what the record would have sounded like when you first bought it around World War I, because this turns out to be Caruso singing In Gemisco from the Messa de Requiem, the Requiem Mass by Verdi. Since it's around Easter, I suppose it's appropriate to play something religious, although I'm Jewish born and I've been an atheist since the age of 8. Nevertheless, let's play Caruso singing one of his quite a number of religious recordings. Wonder what he'd make of an Argentinian pope. This is Caruso on the 7th of January 1915. He was by this time about to be 43 years old. The last records that he made increasingly show a voice that was beginning to show the signs of wear and effort. Now, none of his records are really bad by any stretch of the imagination, but you do begin to get the feeling of much more effort in getting to his top notes, which he reaches all right, and even the just beginning of a slight wobble on those top notes. Indeed, his old friend Giuseppe De Luca, the great baritone, when he heard Caruso around this time after a gap of years, actually remarked how shocked he was at the sound of Caruso's voice. It had become heavier and darker, mainly due to the heavier roles that he was now singing. But he missed that carefree lyric sound of Caruso's youth, and really he was right. Nevertheless, this is probably about the last time Caruso was at his absolute best. There are no better recordings of this aria than Caruso's. You might say Björling's version is a rival. His caressing of notes, his passion, his innate musicality are all here, and of course the wonderful velvet, rich, molten gold tone of Caruso's voice. So, Caruso in Gemisco.
Oh,
Enrico Caruso, the great Caruso. Well, equally great, but in a completely different genre of music, and even more shortly lived than Caruso, and they both smoked, by the way, is the next artist, Django Reinhardt, or as probably it's pronounced in France, Django Reinhardt. He was born in 1910, was involved in the fire which paralyzed two fingers on his arm, which made everything he did in terms of solo work even more amazing, because he's doing it with only two fingers out of four. He, of course, became famous alongside Stéphane Grappelli in the quintet of the Hot Club of France. However, during World War II, Grappelli managed to get to England and spent the war there, whereas Django remained in France and became not only the great musician that he was, but probably also something of a symbol against the weight of the Nazi occupation of Paris. Since he did not have Stéphane Grappelli to play with, he used a clarinet player in his quintet called Hubert Rostand, who is a very fine musician, possibly underrated. This track is one of Django's standards because, as I've always said, his soloing is not only brilliant technically, but he also had that rare ability to almost write songs on the hoof, as it were. His solos are always very, very melodic, sometimes coming in sideways, as he does in this example. He doesn't play the notes you expect him to start with, but his actual compositions are very, very singable. This one has become a sort of a standard within a certain percentage of the jazz fraternity. It's called Swing 42, although it was actually recorded in September 1941, obviously looking always to the future. This is then the definitive recording of Django Reinhardt playing Swing 42 with Hubert Rostand in Paris, 1941. Wonderful. Django Reinhardt during World War II. As I said before, he only lived to the age of 43. Caruso, who also died young, was born in 1873, but the next artist, another great in his particular form of entertainment, was born as early as 1852. He died, however, at the end of 1945, well into his 90s, and indeed was still performing on stage at 91. He was born in Stepney in East London, and his name when he was born was Charles Whitton McCallum, but everybody knew him by the name he stole from the name of the Coburn Road near Mile End as Charles Coburn. He was a small man, and he was never, in a way, fully accepted by the music hall fraternity. Nevertheless, he was one of its greats. And his fame is sort of based on two songs. I've given you one of them way back in, I don't know, program 345, something like that. That was Two Lovely Black Eyes. This one was called The Man Who Broke the Bank at Monte Carlo. And in those pre-television days, everybody wanted to hear him do this live, and he worked out that he must have sung this song about 250,000 times on stage, and he'd learnt to sing it in about 14 different languages. You can see him on YouTube at the same sort of age as you hear him here in 1929, when he was in his late 70s already, but still at the top of his game. So this is Charles Coburn singing The Man Who Broke the Bank at Monte Carlo. He didn't, by the way, write this song. It was written by Fred Gilbert in 1892, but it was the song which really cemented his fame. Charles Coburn.
I've just been here through Paris from the sunny southern shore. I see Monte Carlo wind, just to raise me wind and rent. Same fortune smiled upon me as she never smiled before. And I've now got lots of money, I'm a gent. Yes, I've now just got a rhino, I'm a gent. As I walk along the Bois de Boulogne with an independent air, you'd hear the girl declare, he must be a millionaire. You'd hear them sigh and wish that I could see them wink with the other eye at the man who broke the bank at Monte Carlo. As I walk along the Bois de Boulogne with an independent air, you'd hear the girl declare, he must be a millionaire. Hear them sigh and wish that I would see them wink the other eye at the man who broke the bank at Monte Carlo. I stay indoors till after lunch and then me daily walk to the great triumphal arch, each one grand triumphal march. Observe, right observer, with the keenness of a hawk, I'm a mass of money, linen, silk and starch. I'm a mass of money, linen, silk and starch. As I walk along the Bois de Boulogne with an independent air, you can hear the girl declare, he must be a millionaire. You can hear them sigh and wish that I would see them wink to the other eye at the man who broke the bank at Monte Carlo. As I walk along the Bois de Boulogne with an independent air, you can hear the girl declare, he must be a millionaire. I patronized the tables at the Monte Carlo Hill till they hadn't got a sou for a Christian or a Jew. I then flew off to Paris for the charms of Mademoiselle, who's the darling of my heart. What can I do when with 20 tongues she swears that she grew? As I walk along the Bois de Boulogne with an independent air, could hear the girl declare, must be a millionaire. Could hear them sigh and wish that I would see them wink to the other eye at the man who broke the bank at Monte Carlo. As I walk along the Bois de Boulogne with an independent air, could hear the girl declare, must be a millionaire. Could hear them sigh and wish that I would see them wink to the other eye at the man who broke the bank at
Charles Coburn doing what really only he could do. With Spade the Toff on stage, but as I explained, he came from very much working class stock, as so many of the greats seemed to have done. Now we're going to go to possibly the greatest of them all. If Caruso was the greatest tenor, then maybe this man was the greatest opera singer of all time. Not only did he revolutionize singing, but through a person who used to watch him act, a man called Stanislavski, he also had a great effect on the history of acting. I speak, of course, of Fyodor Shalyapin, 1873 to 1938. He died at 65 of what I believe leukemia. At the age of 59, however, he was still at the height of his powers, and he had rather an unexpected hit record. Every now and then the public picks up on something you don't expect them to. I played before a religious piece sung by Caruso, in 1932, Shalyapin recorded, along with the Russian Church Choir of Paris, where he was by then living, two compositions which were actually by contemporary Russian composers, Gretchaninov and Arkhangelsky. I'm going to give you the side which, strangely, is sort of mostly all on one note, but it's amazing. It sort of grabs your ear. It's all because behind that one note, all sorts of harmonies are happening with the choir. And there's a bass in there who's an octave below Shalyapin. It's the most amazing record. And it builds up to a fantastic climax, I think. So this is what's known as the Twofold Litany, recorded by Fyodor Shalyapin in Paris in 1932. One of those great, great all-time records. And it's sold by thousands and thousands. If you go through boxes of 78s, as I've always done, you'll pretty much come across this record very soon. It was in the Red Label catalogue of HMV pretty much to the end of the 78 era. It stayed there for the next 30 years. Fyodor Shalyapin, the great Fyodor Shalyapin at his best.
Вседержитель, Божий Отец наш, молимся, услыши и помилуй. Помилуй нас, Боже, о великой милости Твоей, молимся, услыши и помилуй. Великих вселенских православных святейших патриарших, о преосвященных епископе и всей во Христе Брати о богохранимой державе российской и о спасении ее.
Господи, помилуй, Господи, помилуй.
Еще молимся о блаженном преснопамятных создателях святого храма сего и о всех прежде почивших отец и братья дельнейшащих и повсюду у православных. Жизни, мире, здравии, спасении, посещении, прощении и оставлении грехов, правобожьих, братьев и святого праздника. Чащих и добродеющих во святем и всечестнем храме всем, кружкающихся, поющих и предстоящих людям, ожидающих от Тебя.
Amen.
the truly great Fyodor Shalyapin. As with everybody else on the show today, there's something about the really great artists that, though they're long gone, you feel that they're somehow still alive and that you might meet them going down the street. That's how strongly their personality has imprinted itself into the wax of many, many decades ago. And that's certainly true of our next performer, another great bass, but again in a very different style. He was born in 1898 and died in 1976. And as you may remember, if you've been listening since the beginning, he was the first person I ever heard sing live. Sadly, his voice wasn't as magnificent as it was here back in 1949, because just a few years later, he went through an awful time in America when McCarthyism hit. However, there was a time, long, long ago, though it may seem difficult to believe, when there was quite a strong influence of socialism within the millions of people who inhabited the USA, and some of them wrote songs about the right to strike and other protest songs. No, they did not invent the protest song in the 1960s, and some of them are jolly sight better than anything that Bob Dylan ever wrote. This is one of them. It's called Joe Hill, a mythical Union man who obviously was killed at some point, and yet somehow the spirit of that man lived on to inspire future generations of Union people to fight for their rights. That's what this song is obviously about. Paul Robeson sings this with just a piano accompaniment, and he was recording for Columbia in 1949, and for some reason at that point the Columbia recording studio made fantastic recordings, sound quality wise. It's as if this recording were made last week, except that it isn't stereo. So this is Paul Robeson sounding absolutely wonderful, singing this powerful song, this left-wing song, left-wing politics, which has become such anathema in the USA of today. Paul Robeson singing Joe Hill.
I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, here 10 years dead, I never died, says he. I never died, says he. In Salt Lake City, Joe says I, him standing by my bed. They framed you on a murder charge, says Joe, but I'm dead. Says Joe, but I'm dead. The copper bosses killed you, Joe. They shot you, Joe, says I. Takes more than guns to kill a man, says Joe, I didn't die. Says Joe, I didn't die. And standing there as big as life, and smiling with his eyes, says Joe, what they can never kill, went on to organize, went on to organize. From San Diego up to Maine, in every mine and mill, where workers strike and organize, it's there you'll find your hill. It's there you'll find. I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he. I never.
the one and only Paul Robeson. Well, we're getting towards the end of the program now, and of course there's been one of my heroes I haven't yet played a record of, and of course I'm speaking of Duke Ellington. Now, talk about personality, talk about genius. But I've told you lots and lots about Duke Ellington because I've played you more than one track of him over the months. I'd like to play this track because it's from that late 40s band that nobody seems to talk about. Everybody knows his great, great periods were the Cotton Club years when he was forming his sound from, say, 28 to 34, and this amazing burst of creativity in the early 40s when he had new band members which seemed to send him into heaven in terms of composition. He had Black, Brown and Beige, major concert at the Carnegie Hall, and now he began to really believe in himself. But of course, at the end of the war, a lot of bands broke up because everybody was leaving the forces, there were economic problems and all that sort of stuff. People couldn't afford to have a big band on the road. He could because of the royalties that he still had from all his hit songs coming in from all sides. And that's why he ran a band for the rest of his life. I personally don't think the band was ever quite what it had been after 1950. That's not to say that the last 25 years of his life didn't produce great records now and then. I particularly recommend, for instance, if you go to YouTube and listen to 430 Blues, wonderful track. But in general, the late 40s is sort of overlooked, and particularly this soloist. His name was Al Sears. I met him at his home, really lovely man he was. I remember it was freezing cold then as well. I was in New York. I had a hired car and it wouldn't start, and he got out his jump leads and started me up. He was in his 70s then. He only lived to the age of 80, so I must have seen him in the 1980s, in the last decade of his life. As I say, lovely man. He was born in 1910, died in 1990 in New York City. He was almost destined to be with Duke Ellington for a while because his first major job was replacing Johnny Hodges, of all people, but in Chick Webb's band back then. Then he played with Elmer Snowden, who, of course, ran the original band where Duke Ellington started. Then he ran his own groups for a while, but then he was picked up by Andy Kirk, the great band leader, and then Lionel Hampton, until in 1944 he was sort of headhunted by Duke Ellington to replace, of all people, Ben Webster, which was a fairly heavy-duty thing to live up to. But he finally left 5 years later because he wanted to be his own leader again, and rock and roll was on the way. He wrote a song called Castle Rock, which he recorded with Johnny Hodges later, which became a big hit for him, and he spent the next couple of decades being a session musician, playing a lot of rock and roll, because they needed good tenor players for that too. Well, here he is showing what he could really do in a piece that Duke Ellington wrote to showcase his particular skills, and it's a high-speed 2-4 romper called the Suburbanite, and to this day, Al Sears is remembered, if for nothing else, for his solo on this great definitive record of Duke Ellington, recorded on the 1st of July, 1946, Al Sears with the Duke Ellington Orchestra. Thank you. Duke Ellington with Al Sears. Well, I haven't rabbited on too much today, so I can maybe slip in an extra track. Peggy Lee, my favourite of popular singers, made a fantastic version of the song Lover. And she had the concept of what this arrangement should be. Gordon Jenkins very generously later said, it was absolutely her idea. She laid it out for me, not literally the music notes, but the tempo and the Latin drummers and the whole pseudo-sexy feel of the thing, changing keys a couple of times. Her idea was that the Latin drummers would suggest the hooves of horses and it would all get very excited. Gordon Jenkins said, everybody's running around saying what a brilliant arranger I was, but the whole conception of the thing was hers. Needless to say, Peggy Lee said, that's ridiculous. I just had an idea for the rhythm section, nothing to do with the whole orchestration, and he brought my concept to life. I had no idea that he could embellish so beautifully. Well, of course, I'm sure that's right. It might have been her idea, but without the genius of Gordon Jenkins' arrangement, this would never have been. This is then the amazing version, and Peggy Lee actually left Capitol and joined Decca in order to record this because Capitol didn't want to do it. This is the result, Lover. They had a lot of trouble recording it, though, because with a big orchestra, they couldn't pick up her vocal, and they pretty much invented the isolation booth, which is so normal now in recording, so that they could keep her vocal away from the recording of the rest of the band. It is a classic. Peggy Lee's 1952 version of Lover.
Lover, when you're near me and I hear you speak my name softly in my ear, you breathe a flame. Lover, it's immoral, but why quarrel with our bliss when two lips of coral want to kiss? To resist you I try, but if you didn't continue, I would die. Lover, please be tender when your tender fears depart. Lover, please surrender to my heart. Lover, when you're near me and I hear you speak my name softly,
Peggy Lee, fantastic record. Well, as you know, this is my 50th program, and Mostly, I've just been wanting to share my 78 record collection with you, but also, some of you will know that I'm also a performer myself. And by playing you all these of my favourite performers, you have some idea of the people who have influenced me. And if you aim at the level at which these people operated, then hopefully it improves your own standard. I will never share with you, you'll be pleased to hear, recordings of me singing in the bathroom trying to be Caruso and Shalyapin, nor even Paul Robeson. My jazz phrasing does come from people like Louis Armstrong, there wasn't room to put him on this particular program, and Peggy Lee and Ella Fitzgerald, but of course I'm not going to sound like them either. I try my best to write songs as well as Puccini did, or George Gershwin, or Cole Porter, or whoever these great names were, because they also were young wannabes once, and maybe older people, still not sure how good they were. Nobody's ever got that amount of ego that they're sure that the next song will be as good as everything they've written before. So it's about me too. There was a time, of course, when I didn't realise that I couldn't sing like, say, Paul Robeson. And at that time, my voice hadn't even broken yet, and I was 12 years old. And thus, I recorded one of my favourite tracks of Paul Robeson that I haven't actually played you yet. And this is a Welsh hymn that he recorded for some unknown reason called Ebenezer. I don't think it appeared in the film that he made in Wales, but I love this tune, and so I recorded it. So this is the third religious track of this podcast. It only remains for me to say, as always, please, if you've enjoyed this, pass on the link. If you're on Facebook, it's easy, just share it. Send it by email to your friends, write it down on a bit of paper and tell people, because there are now already 50 programs of this stuff, which means I've put on something like 300 tracks, but there's lots more. I have 10,000 records here. The quality of stuff before vinyl was amazing. So until the next time, which will be program 51, and we start all over again, as it were, I wish you all the best. Please share the link to these recordings, and till then, au revoir.